And Sarah Putt is in the Auckland studio. Very good morning to you.
Good morning. How's it going?
Oh, you're on the phone by the sounds of that. I'm really good, thank you. 2 degrees now getting into the 5G party, as you call it. That's no small step for a smaller player in the market.
Absolutely. It's a huge investment. And 2 degrees is probably the challenger network. It's 12 years old, which surprised me when I thought about it. It feels like it hasn't been around a huge long time, but, you know, over a decade. And as we know, Spark and Vodafone have been very active talking up their 5G investments, and now it's time for 2 degrees. They're going to upgrade 700 of their 1,800 sites, starting in Auckland and Wellington this year, and it's going with a vendor called Ericsson to roll out this technology.
All right. What will the significance be for the company and for its users?
So basically, in the past, the sort of 3G and 4G network were done by Huawei. And as we know, they had a similar experience that Spark had, who also had Huawei, in that due to geopolitical issues, i.e., you know, issues around China and building the network, the GCSB, the government agency, pretty effectively banned them or barred them from using that vendor. So they've been in the market looking for another one, and they've come up with Ericsson. They've pointed out that they've already spent $1 billion on their current network, and this will be an actual quite a almost like a swap out. It'll be end-to-end Ericsson technology, what it will mean for customers in the first instance is what most customers will see on the other networks as well when they have 5G capable smartphones is faster data speeds, probably that kind of thing in the first instance. You'll just notice that things are faster and more responsive. But over time, we expect 5G to bring in a lot more different sort of innovation. You'll probably see it in the business area first, because what it will enable is millions and millions of connected devices. And so those are the sort of things that you'll see. You'll see business applications and then consumer applications. It's quite a hard one to talk about the difference of 5G, because they expect the use cases to evolve over time. But in the first instance, it will just be better experience.
Who are the others with, and where are they at in their rollout, the bigger players?
Yeah, so Spark has been talking for some time about its rollout, and it's been in, it's kind of started in South Island areas and smaller towns, and it's gradually coming into the cities. And Vodafone's done the same thing, and so they're in the cities as well. The latest announcement with Spark was that it was in Christchurch, and that actually went with a vendor called Samsung, which is quite new to rolling out this kind of technology. But they're also with Nokia, and Vodafone's with Nokia. So they're basically coming in, sort of spreading out throughout the country. So about 2 degrees coming on board and announcing this means that customers across all three networks can expect to see 5G being implemented over time. You won't miss out if you're on 2 degrees, basically.
Okay. With the announcement, what is the impact on the company itself? What is its status? Is it looking to list?
Yes, absolutely. So it's majority owned, 73%, by a company called Trilogy International. And they basically own two networks, one in New Zealand and one in Bolivia. And they have pretty much been the owner or majority owner since it first began 12 years ago. And they're looking to, they are headquartered in Canada. So they're based, they're actually listed in Canada. And so they're basically looking to sell the network. And they announced about a month ago that they were looking to do an IPO to list on the New Zealand Stock Exchange. Which will be really kind of interesting. It'll be, it's actually quite interesting that Vodafone and Vocus, other telcos, have also talked about listing on the stock exchange and haven't. They've been sold or things have changed in their ownership status before they got to list. So if 2 degrees gets to list, it'll be good for the NZX. It'll be interesting for New Zealanders to be able to invest in the network. But obviously these things don't happen until they actually happen. But what we'll see probably over the next few months, if they do list, probably end of the year or early next, we'll see a lot more publicity from 2 degrees. We'll see a lot more announcements around, this is like 5G announcement. We'll see new plans, those kinds of things. You can expect to see a lot more as they push and try to sell this company.
The impact is happening from 5G already, looking more broadly.
Yeah. So it's not just timing in terms of, of their own company's, status. It's also good timing in terms of now we're seeing more 5G-capable phones. For ages, we've just been talking about it, but basically Apple came out with its iPhone 12, its latest iPhone iteration, last year, and sort of towards the end of last year, the last quarter, and that's just boosted 5G-capable phones in New Zealand. Apparently, they shipped 200,000 of them last quarter, accounting for like just under half of all shipments in New Zealand for smartphones. So they are very much, people are starting to get these 5G capable phones in their hands, and it looks like now they'll be able to take advantage of the networks that are slowly being built out.
Well, our next story now is Myanmar, of course, with the coup and the awful events unfolding since. Mm-hmm. Journalists know full well that the internet has been being interfered with, as have phone lines, as we have endeavoured to conduct interviews there. What else are we learning about the extent of the disruptions to the internet?
Yeah, so absolutely. And whenever democracy gets sidelined, the first thing is the information flow. And as you point out, since the 1st of February, Myanmar's military coup have been very active in disrupting the ability for their people to communicate. First of all, it's social media. That's the first thing they clamp down on. And so Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, WhatsApp, all those things are banned. And then it's like there's been intermittent cuts to the internet access. So apparently over half the country, and 54 million people in Myanmar, over half of them have access to smartphones and were using the internet regularly, obviously, for lots of reasons. But what's been happening is they've had intermittent cutoffs. Often at night, they'll just cut down the wireless access. To stop people from spreading information and the protest movement from being able to communicate. Now, they'll often keep the fibre network going because that keeps the businesses, the big businesses going, the organisations, the government, that kind of thing functioning. And most of the population can't afford fibre connectivity. So they're cutting off this wireless internet at night. It's been very, very disruptive.
This is, as you say, unfortunately, par for the course, whatever communication systems are. What are we hearing about just how kind of brutal the crackdown is?
Well, human rights groups are reporting through companies like, from outlets like Guardian, etc. They're basically saying around 700 people have been killed in protest action since the shutdown, and at least 3,000 people detained, often journalists, people like that. It is very serious for people trying to distribute, information that the military government doesn't agree with. And they're trying to get around these restrictions in very interesting ways. Sometimes it's through network apps, looking at apps that enable Bluetooth functionality. Sometimes it's through VPNs. And sometimes it's just really old-fashioned. The South China Morning Post had a really good, interesting story about a group that's creating a publication called Molotov, which is designed to appeal to young people. And that's around how they're distributing it is just, if they can't send the PDF via the internet, they're literally printing it off and walking through the markets and giving it to people at great risk to their lives, probably.
All right. And really, shutdowns are being documented, and the extent of it is beginning to be documented, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah.
People, as you mentioned, though, finding their way around the restrictions, and we know this from other countries as well, that there are some apps or some means by which you can get around things, but undoubtedly a very heavy crackdown.
Absolutely. And Myanmar is itself one of those countries that has a form, for want of a better word, when it comes to internet shutdowns. There's an international organization called Access Now, and they document internet shutdowns. And in 2020, there were 155 that they were able to document. That's compared to the year before, where there were 213. But they say don't read anything into the fact that there were less last year. It may have been because of the pandemic that these internet shutdowns weren't as active. But it's not just economic consequences. It's, you know, it's the entire thing. It's a way of ensuring that people can't share and be democratic communications, etc.
Finally today, should you name a robot? Wow, is this an ethical, a philosophical, an existential question?
Everything, Catherine. I do think it's everything, because I think that more and more we're starting to see robots and artificial intelligence and all of that come into our lives. I mean, we started with things like, Siri and Alexa, Apple and Amazon, Cortana if you're Microsoft, and then local companies like Air New Zealand put out chatbots, and they called that Oscar. And if you go on to Countdown Supermarket, the Olive, the chatbot, and that's all very well and good. But now we're starting to see it come into the workforce as well, into your workplace, and through things like robotic process automation, which is just kind of a tech way of saying, getting the robot or getting the machine to do the invoicing, and those kind of tasks that can take humans a long time, but, robots can speed through them. But what's happening is that as they're coming into the workforce, people are concerned, obviously, that automation will take over their jobs and their roles and their future. And so basically a lot of businesses are doing are saying, no, that's not true. What we're trying to do is take the low-level, manual stuff away so you can be involved in more high-end tasks, more interesting tasks. And in doing so, we're going to make this robot part of the workforce. And I think it's time to sort of say, well, actually, they're not humans. They're not machines. And often by naming robots, you actually personalise something that isn't personal.
Well, so what happens if you go off your robot?
Exactly. Well, they're just so jolly efficient, aren't they? I mean, but there does need to be that distinction made. And I think sometimes we just allow all this stuff to come into our world. And there's a lot of debate in technology circles around whether or not the way that we relate to machines, we need to have that distinction, because they are different to humans, but they can do things much better than humans can, like crunch through invoicing, for example.
They can, but there is this argument again, should they be used more in care homes or in hospitals to provide company? And I, find myself having a fairly strong reflexive reaction to that, which is, how about we get some humans doing that?
Exactly.
But then, unfortunately, you read research that suggests, hey, if it works, who's to say no? Is this quite a debate at the moment as to whether we are anthropomorphising robots too much?
Absolutely. And I think that's a debate that needs to happen, because what will happen is it will become more and more a part of everyday life. Like I said, in the workforce, where you might have expected people to do these roles, you've now got robots. That is good if it allows people to do the more human tasks. But at the same time, what are you giving away when you create a machine? They've got their own email addresses. They've got their own sort of, name, space, whatever in the business. I just think that it's quite nice to have a barrier there as to be quite distinct. This is a robot. I mean, do we go back to just calling them technical names, which is the other side of the coin, right? People don't want to be told about server 356. They want to be told what it is and what it does in plain language. So there's a lot to get through there.
There sure is. And so where do you land? Are you going to name some robots but not others?
Well, that's an interesting one. I mean, I think one of the things you've got to be able to do, and I was speaking to a business called Mercy Radiology in Auckland the other day, and one of the things that they've done is that they sort of wanted to name the robots and have the robots in the business, because it meant that people would understand where, that they would understand that they could actually improve their own service and be freed up to do those human tasks that you talked about. And so in that respect, they named their robots after colleagues and as kind of almost a tribute to colleagues. So that was an interesting approach. But I guess at the end of the day, you've got to say to yourself, where do you want to draw that line?
Thank you so much, as always, Sarah Putz, our tech commentator.